Hello, everybody. Welcome to the English 210 podcast. My name is Jessica Lee. We're going to be talking about voice in this podcast. I'm going to be supplementing class time with this podcast. In an ideal world, we would do all of these exercises in person, but it's not an ideal world, so we'll take advantage of MP3s in our web-based classroom. Now, in order to get the most out of the voice lesson, I'll be requiring that you follow along and do some exercises in your journal. I'll be looking for those when I collect and grade your journals. Okay, so first, what do we mean when we talk about voice? Different authors have different things to say about it. Writers often talk about the process of finding their voice, which is described in almost mystical terms sometimes. Granted, this speaks to the aspects of writing that you really can't put your finger on. Those elements are there, particularly in fiction. You'll hear authors talk about the characters taking on a life of their own. And I don't deny that this aspect of writing exists. I've felt it as a writer. But I can't teach that. What I can teach are the more technical elements. To talk about writing as if it were this completely inexplicable, mysterious process misleads a bit, and it ignores the fact that those years spent leading up to finding your voice involves lots of reading and imitating. Francine Prose has a book called Reading Like a Writer. It's very practical about the acquisition of individual style. I highly recommend it. Now, I'm going to draw your attention to the nuances of grammar, sentence lengths, the occurrence of fragments, the frequency of polysyllabic words, and the like. We'll get to the meaning of all those things soon, but for now it's important that you realize you can approach style through examining some of the minutiae of writing. Stepwise, we begin by looking at authors and identifying the devices they use. We move on to exercises that play with the number of syllables in your words and the number of words in your sentences, and so on. We look at more writers and begin to imitate them. Then we reach the ultimate experiment with voice, practicing what the French writer Raymond Queneau called exercises in style, in which he told one story 99 different ways. In fact, there's a book out now called 99 Ways to Tell a Story that owes a debt to Queneau. Consider this podcast a laboratory for creating voice. Probably the most typical examples of extremes in writing style are still Ernest Hemingway and William Faulkner. It seems that in the 20th and 21st century, we've just been working with that continuum, Hemingway to Faulkner. Hemingway is often cited for his brevity, and he was explicitly aware of his clean economical style. He knew what he was doing. Hemingway once said, "It wasn't by accident that the Gettysburg Address was so short. The laws of prose are as immutable as those of flight, of mathematics, of physics." What did Hemingway mean by that? By comparing prose to math and physics, indeed by using the phrase laws of prose, Hemingway suggests that the best writing obeys our ancient preference for simplicity over complexity. I'm going to read a short passage from The Old Man and the Sea, and I want you to just listen to the simplicity. You really should have this in front of you as we look at this passage. So I'm going to probably post this on Blackboard so you can follow along. But for now, let me just read from Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea. They sailed well, and the old man soaked his hands in the salt water and tried to keep his head clear. There were high cumulus clouds and enough cirrus above them so that the old man knew the breeze would last all night. The old man looked at the fish constantly to make sure it was true. It was an hour before the first shark hit him. The shark was not an accident. He had come up from deep down in the water as the dark cloud of blood had settled and dispersed in the mild deep sea. He had come up so fast and absolutely without caution that he broke the surface of the blue water and was in the sun. Then he fell back into the sea and picked up the scent and started swimming on the course the skiff and the fish had taken. Why don't we listen to a little bit of Charlton Heston reading this? I think I have some. Now, copyright laws are kind of vague about this. I'm using the fair use educational clause of copyright, which just means I'm using short passages for educational purposes, and there is no commercial gain. And the section of Charlton Heston is going to be really brief. I just want maybe you to hear a professional reading this, and it's from a different part of the book, so don't expect continuity.
The fish never changed its course nor its direction all that night, as far as the man could tell from watching the stars. It was cold after the sun went down, and the old man's sweat dried cold on his back, in his arms, in his old legs. During the day, he'd taken the sack that covered the big box and spread it in the sun to dry. After the sun went down, he tied it around his neck so that it hung down over his back, and he cautiously worked it down under the line that was across his shoulders now. The sack cushioned the line, and he'd found a way of leaning forward against the bow so that he was almost comfortable. The position actually was only somewhat less intolerable, but he thought of it as almost comfortable.
Yay, let's hear it for the pro. Okay, so ideally you have this passage in front of you, the passage I read earlier. So, my question for you, what level of vocabulary does Hemingway use? Is he using lots of fancy words? Not really. They're mostly monosyllabic, one-syllable words. And his sentences are, for the most part, simple and short. So this idea of using only the essential words, the bare minimum, carries over into a writer's work as a whole. Anton Chekhov, the playwright, famously said, "If a shotgun hangs on the wall in the first act, it must go off in the last act." In other words, don't waste anything, and don't mislead your readers. Okay, now I'm going to give William Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom a shot. This is just the first paragraph and a half, and we'll see how it goes. From a little after 2 o'clock until almost sundown of the long, still, hot, weary, dead September afternoon, they sat in what Miss Coldfield still called the office, because her father had called it that, a dim, hot, airless room with the blinds all closed and fastened for 43 summers, because when she was a girl, someone had believed that light and moving air carried heat and that dark was always cooler, and which, as the sun shone fuller and fuller on that side of the house, became latticed with yellow slashes full of dust motes, which Quentin thought of as being flecks of the dead old dried paint itself blown inward from the scaling blinds as wind might have blown them. There was a wisteria vine blooming for the second time that summer on a wooden trellis before one window, in which sparrows came now and then in random gusts, making a dry, vivid, dusty sound before going away. And opposite Quentin, Miss Caulfield, in the eternal black, which she had worn for 43 years now, whether for sister or father or not husband, none knew, sitting so bold upright in the straight, hard chair that was so tall for her that her legs hung straight and rigid, as if she had iron shin bones and ankles, clear of the floor with that air of impotent and static rage like children's feet, and talking in that grim, haggard, amazed voice until at last listening would renege and hearing sense self-confound and the long-dead object of her impotent yet indomitable frustration would appear as though by outraged recapitulation evoked, quiet, inattentive, and harmless out of the biting and dreamy and victorious dust." That's really hard. Okay, so you should have this piece in front of you. What do you notice first about punctuation? How many sentences are there? Punctuation plays a huge role in Faulkner's prose. If he didn't make good use of punctuation, we'd be completely lost in his long, complex sentences. When I read an entire Faulkner novel, I find myself stopping sometimes and asking, wait, what was the subject of the sentence? The verb? And sometimes I have to flip back a couple pages, maybe that's exaggerating, before I can find the beginning of the sentence and reconstruct the main idea. Another thing you may have noticed is that most of the words at the beginning there actually were monosyllabic. They were pretty simple words. It's only towards the end there when not only is the punctuation and the sheer length of the sentences piling up all this pressure that you then get impotent, indomitable frustration, recapitulation, inattentiveness, etc. So he actually is more minimal in his word choice than you might think. But this lesson is not to simply praise minimalism and highlight the shortcomings of thick descriptive language. Most prose, after all, falls between these two extremes. Besides, Faulkner has an entire chapter composed of one sentence, "My mother is a fish." On the subject of punctuation, listen to this excerpt from an essay called In Praise of the Comma by Pico Iyer. I hope that's how you pronounce his name. Listen for the commas, and with the piece in front of you, note how often and where the periods fall, and the semicolons, and finally the commas themselves. So in the middle of an essay celebrating the comma, it goes like this. Thus, all these tiny scratches give us breadth and heft and depth. A world that has only periods is a world without inflections. It is a world without shade. It has a music without sharps and flats. It is a martial music. It has jackboot rhythm. Words cannot bend and curve. A comma, by comparison, catches the gentle drift of mind and thought, turning in on itself and back on itself, reversing, redoubling, and returning along the course of its own sweet river music, while the semicolon brings clauses and thoughts together with all the silent discretion of a hostess arranging guests around her dinner table. Punctuation is the notation in the sheet music of our own words, telling us when to rest or when to raise our voices. It acknowledges that the meaning of our discourse, as of any symphonic composition, lies not in the units but in the pauses, the pacing, and the phrasing. Punctuation is the way one bats one's eyes, lowers one's voice, or blushes demurely. Punctuation adjusts color and tone and volume till the feeling comes into perfect focus. Not disgust exactly, but not distaste, not lust or like, but love. Okie dokie. All right, so to start to wrap up and give you your first exercises, remember these elements: level of vocabulary, predominantly monosyllabic or polysyllabic words, that's one syllable or many syllables, number of sentences ending in one syllable hard consonant sounds. Are there many simple or complex sentences? What is the frequency of the use of sentence fragments? What is the average sentence length? Is there much length variation? What about the frequency of the use of conjunctions, and, but, for, etc.? Punctuation within sentences, interruptions, lists, clauses joined by semicolons. Your writing voice is made up of sentence patterns, sentence length, word choice, word placement, and punctuation. All these larger issues, like tone and style, are made up of these lower order stylistic features. Quick note about short sentences. When you have to cut to the chase, go straight to the important stuff. For years, I've been borrowing a short sentences fragments lesson from Donna Hickey's book called Developing a Written Voice. She says, the closer key elements come together, the more forceful the sound of the message is. Okay, short sentences emphasize information, long sentences do not. Just like in the poetic line, the more powerful positions in a sentence are the first and last words. The closer together, the more forceful the message. The shorter the sentence, the more likely it is that the reader will remember it. With that in mind, sometimes the fragment can be the creative writer's best friend. But to be an effective fragment, it must warrant its own sentence space. Does it add rhythm? Does it help to establish an intonation pattern you want to convey? She says, an effective fragment follows logically from the sentence before it and forms a coherent, complete thought, even if, grammatically, the sentence is incomplete. And she suggests a test. Can the reader attach it to an adjacent independent clause? Consider this passage by William Gass on the color blue. Then there is the cold Canadian climate and the color of deep ice, the gill of a fish, lush grass, the whale, jay, ribbon, fin. She suggests that we listen to a different version and see what is musical lost in it. How about this? Fin, jay, the whale, the gill of a fish, ribbon, lush grass. So there's no hurrying by the image. Okay, ready for exercise one, practicing monosyllabic writing. This is also originally from Hickey's book. It's been a part of my creative writing classes for 10 years. Write a fully developed paragraph with the following constraints. And since this is not timed, then time yourself. Give yourself about 10 minutes tops. Okay, here are the constraints. Number one, no punctuated sentence. By that, we can include fragment, anything that begins with a capital letter and ends with a period. So, rule one, no punctuated sentence has more than 10 words. The shortest sentence has one word. So, one example, you can use fragments. Try not to rely on them, though. Try this, he made another wrestling move, period. 2 points, period. And constraint number two, no word has more than one syllable. That's right. She made her move. Score. It was a long match. The goal may have been to win. This sort of thing. All one-syllable words. And we'll see what you come up with, and we'll talk about it in the next class. So don't forget your journals. You'll need those so we can read your exercises aloud. Good luck, and thank you for listening.